It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. There's something about an aviation mystery that captures the attention of the American public. And I don't think there has been an aviation mystery since Amelia Earhart that has captured the public's attention and imagination more than the disappearance of MH370 10 years ago. 10 years ago, the world was fixated, watching cable news day in and day out for any hope of a ping, any sign of anything that might have led to the discovery of this airplane. Survivors, and then when it became clear that there were not going to be any survivors, maybe some wreckage. But this does seem to be the airplane that disappeared. Why? What happened? What does it matter 10 years later? What can we learn from it from the future? Will we ever know the truth? Somebody that has been studying this and has dug deep, probably deeper than any journalist that I know, is a journalist that has specialized in aviation, adventure, and psychology. He's also the host of a new podcast on this subject at deepdivemh370.com. My very, very great pleasure to welcome to the program Jeff Wise. Jeff, thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, thanks, Frank. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So what is the, for people that may not remember what occurred 10 years ago or how things ended up at the time, what is the official story about the disappearance of MH370? What do we know for a fact that's incontrovertible?
Well, we know that the plane did not arrive in Beijing. Where it was supposed to arrive was a red-eye flight from Kuala Lumpur. It was supposed to arrive, you know, shortly after dawn on March 8th, 2014. It didn't show up. And it just vanished from air traffic control screens. Later, once people really grokked that something bad had happened, they went back and they looked at the primary radar return, and they saw that it actually had done a 180 turn, flown back over the Malay Peninsula up the Straits of Malacca, and then it had vanished again.
Hmm.
And so one of the reasons this story was just so crazy and so captivating was that, like, new information kept coming out, and each piece of information was crazier than the last. Come to find, about a week later, that there was another whole set of clues that this plane had been exchanging automatic signals with the Inmarsat satellite system. And no information was broadcast, like nobody was making a call or sending an email, but these automatic pings were being sent. And from this, they were able to deduce that the plane had, well, first of all, they couldn't tell if it had flown to Kazakhstan or to the southern Indian Ocean. They could tell it was one of the two of them. And then later they did some mathematics and they were able to determine that it had gone south into the ocean. But where, they set out to search, it took them years of searching. They thought they had it figured out where on the seabed it had to be, but when they looked there, it wasn't there. And then after about 16 months, stuff started to wash up. The first piece came ashore on a French island called La Réunion, which is near Madagascar in the western part of the Indian Ocean. And eventually they got about three dozen pieces of debris. So they thought, they interpreted that as meaning, well, the plane must be in the southern Indian Ocean somewhere, but we just don't know where. And they spent a lot of money searching a huge area of the seabed, very deep, and they never found it. And they basically just gave up.
Were you deeply interested in this story from the moment it happened, or did you come to be interested in it a bit later?
Well, like the first day I heard about it, I was like, it sounds like a normal plane crash. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like there had been a bunch of things late at that time that had happened, and it didn't seem particularly special to me. But as very quickly, it was like, wait, there were some very peculiar aspects to this case, and I got sucked into it. And I was going on CNN like five times a day, and you know, you'll recall it was all CNN wanted to talk about for the whole month.
I remember. So, what was the thing that made you realize this is no ordinary plane crash?
Very quickly, we learned that the plane had gone dark about 6 seconds after it left the last waypoint in Malaysian airspace. And there's a thing that happens with air traffic control. I fly little planes, and so I've experienced this myself at a slightly different level of professionalism. But when you leave one area of air traffic control, they tell you, change the radio frequency you're talking on and call the next guy. It's called a handoff, right? Mm. And so you say goodbye to one guy, and then you have like a certain amount of time to call the next guy. In between, nobody, you're not under anybody's watch. Nobody's paying attention to you. And 6 seconds into that transition, this plane goes dark and pulls a hard 180. That, to me, was extremely suspicious. It reminded me of this flight that had happened 5 years before, Air France 447, which had disappeared over the middle of the Atlantic en route from Rio de Janeiro up to Paris. And they also had been... they'd gone missing for a long time because nobody was watching them. They were in between air traffic controls, and I thought this is super duper suspicious, and other people did too.
So over the course of the last couple of weeks that we've been talking a great deal about this, I've heard a number of theories. Some mm-hmm. people have suggested a pilot suicide. Other mm-hmm. people have suggested some sort of a mechanical failure. I've done some research online. I've seen all sorts of other wilder and crazier theories. What are, let's say, the three or four theories that you find to be most credible about what may have occurred here? Obviously, understanding there may not be a way to know, at least not yet.
Well, if you look at it carefully, there's only two. There's only two possibilities. Everything else is just kind of supposition based on people's kind of gut instincts. But if you look at it scientifically, if you understand the data that we have, the evidence, let me put it this way. There's only two things that we know about this plane. One is we have a set of data that was recorded by the satellite company. And for 16 months, that's all we had. And no airplane had ever broadcast transmissions like this before. It was very unusual. And then the other set of information we have are these pieces that wash ashore on the Western Indian Ocean. And so that's all we've got. So if your theory doesn't explain either one of those things, it's not really a very useful theory. And so things like mechanical failure, it doesn't take you very long to realize that those doesn't explain what happened. Because what happened is like a very specific, very strange set of circumstances. So the first thing that could have happened is, you mentioned it yourself, it's about pilot suicide. So the pilot, this guy named Zahari Ahmad Shah, is a very experienced senior Malaysian Airlines captain. He must have locked the other guy out and taken the plane and had some very elaborate, very sophisticated, complicated, and protracted plan to fly this plane for 6 hours into the remote ocean, run out of fuel, and crash and die, kill everyone and himself. That's theory one. That, by the way, is kind of what the official theory is. That's what they've never said that that's the theory, but that's really what they all think in the Australian investigators. There's another theory that is very, very few people hold, but I'm one of them. Okay, so I've been looking at this case, and I find there's a lot of anomalies. This is sort of, if people are interested in this, they should definitely check out the podcast, because to understand this case, Frank, this is a very complicated, it's a technical case, and so to understand it, you kind of really have to understand where the data comes from, what does it mean, and it turns out that this plane, as I said, it like sent these very strange signals that had never been encountered before, and it turns out that when it took off from Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, it had a cybersecurity vulnerability. It was unusual in that it had a whole bunch of different features, which most planes don't have, that would allow the data to be tampered with, so that it looked like, so when the mathematicians tackled this very arcane data later, they would come to the conclusion that it went south when actually it went north. Okay, so that vulnerability exists. Now, whether it was exploited or not is another issue. But I said that there was two basically mm-hmm. baskets mm-hmm. of information. One is the Inmarsat data. The other is this debris. Well, one of the things that I revealed with my co-host in our episode that we released last Thursday was that I've talked to a ton of marine biologists, and you can hear some of them in the podcast. What they're telling me is that the barnacles that are growing on these pieces that washed ashore don't match what you would expect to see on pieces that have been floating in the ocean for 16 months. They look more like 4 months. What that means is that there's about a year-long gap between when the plane disappeared and when this debris went in the water.
Hmm.
Which kind of blows people's minds, frankly. It sounds kind of crazy. But, I mean, just every piece has the same problem. It doesn't have the right-sized barnacles on it. And there's other anomalies, too. Like, nothing about these pieces is what you'd expect. And some of them are just flat-out impossible.
So, Jeff, and by the way, if people are just tuning in, we're talking with Jeff Wise. If you're interested in learning more about 370, you got to check out the podcast at deepdivemh370.com. Jeff, given what you said, the anomalies, mm-hmm. the gaps in the barnacle growth of 16 months versus 4 months, what do we divine from that? What do we then think may have happened if
right.
it was not pilot suicide?
Right, exactly. Another thing, by the way, if the pilot had taken it and flown it south, it would have crashed into the ocean and sunk to the seabed, and then it would have been found.
Mm-hmm.
It would have gone to an area that they defined and they would have been able to find. So that itself is another important clue. So where could it have gone? If it didn't go south, the data allows you to generate a pretty narrow range of possible paths. And all these paths wind up in Central Asia, in a country called Kazakhstan, which is a very, very large country. Much of it is desert. And one thing that it's kind of famous for is that it has a large Russian spaceport, basically, that has been there since the dawn of the space age. And there's a great big runway that's in the middle of nowhere that they built so that they could land their version of the space shuttle, which only flew once. So there's, you know, a big runway in the middle of the desert that you could land at if you wanted to.
So the plane, you've landed in Kazakhstan.
So if the plane didn't go south, then it went north. And if it went north, it would go to Kazakhstan. And it would wind up in basically, Kazakhstan is basically a client state of Russia. And so what you're looking at is a Russian hijack. And you know, obviously that sounds a little bit wacko, but Russians have the technology that would, because this, what I'm describing is an almost insanely sophisticated hack. And it's so sophisticated that a lot of people just are like, it's way too sophisticated. Like, nobody could do this. But we're kind of running out of options. Like, it's very, very hard to explain everything we know about this plane in a coherent story that winds up with a plane not being found on the seabed. So another thing to know about Russia and Malaysian Airlines 777s is that there were 16 Malaysian Airlines 777s in the world at the beginning of 2014. And in the span of 4.5 months, two of them came to unhappy fates. One of them vanished, and the other was shot down by Russian military intelligence.
Right, I remember that, sure.
Over Ukraine. So, you know, if you're looking for people who are in the business of, you know, eliminating Malaysian Airlines 777s, there already is a suspect.
So the one that went down, that was shot down by what was believed to be the Russians,
mm-hmm.
Most of the folks that I've heard talk about that believe that it was shot down by accident because
right.
They believe that this was not necessarily a passenger airliner. What would the motive be for the Russians to hijack this MH370 flight?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Why would they take this? Why would they take MH370, and why did they shoot down MH17? And a lot of people have thought, well, it must have been a mistake, right? I mean, because the Russians themselves put out all these noises like, well, it must some untrained militiaman must have somehow captured it from the Ukrainians, and they didn't know what they were doing, and they just kind of fired blindly, and it was an accident. Come to find, actually, months later, this really pretty cool international group of researchers called Bellingcat managed to piece together all this dash cam footage, and they figured out that this missile launcher wasn't operated by a bunch of rogue militiamen. It actually had been brought across the border from Russia. It was a regular Russian army unit under the command of the GRU, which is Russian Military Intelligence. And they sat there on the ground as passenger plane after, it was a very heavily trafficked passenger plane route. And these planes went overhead one after the other for a couple hours, and then they blasted this one particular one out of the sky. Now, why would they do that? Why the hell would they do that? I don't know why they did it, but they did it. We know absolutely. People have already been convicted in court in Amsterdam. Not Amsterdam, but The Hague.
Right, in The Hague, right.
Right. So why would they do this? Well, I don't know. But it sure damn looks like they did it. Hmm. And as far as MH370, maybe it was just a really bad idea. But one thing I can tell you is that at the time that this happened, Russia was in the process of annexing Crimea. So they kind of did it in a sneaky way with little green men. Back in those days, Putin, I think, was a little bit scared about what the international reaction would be. So he didn't want to just roll the tanks over the border like he did, more recently. So He did this thing. He took over Crimea, and the whole world was mad at him. There was a lot of international condemnation. That there was sanctions, and so when MH370 happened, the tension turned away from Crimea.
Mm.
Like CNN didn't mention Crimea again for a couple months, because all they talked about was MH370. It was a distraction, you know.
So you think this potentially, obviously, you not only, I'm asking you not only to hypothesize about a theory, but hypothesize about motive.
Right.
So we won't hold you to whatever you say, but you think the possible motive on the part of the Russians was to distract the international community and the international news media from the scrutiny that Russia was not enjoying regarding the annexation of Crimea?
Yeah, that could be one part of it. Another part of it could be something like when you are, it's kind of a, we're essentially in a Cold War with Russia right now. They're doing things like trying to undermine democracy, assassinating dissidents, this kind of very typical stuff that like the Soviet Union used to do in the 60s and 70s. And so part of it is, it's what they call hybrid warfare. Like you're trying to outmaneuver your enemy, hurt him in ways that he can't react to, and you're trying to understand what you can get away with. It's like a disobedient teenager, right? They're always pushing, always pressing, always seeing what they can get away with. And if they do something and you don't react, then they'll do a little bit more. And with MH370, it was this super subtle thing that, like, I think they realized that, like, if they could do this thing, and they couldn't really get caught, because imagine if President Obama had said, "Oh, these Russians, they did it. I did the math and I figured it out. I did the calculations.
But there's no evidence to show. No, right.
But you haven't got the plane. It's like people would be like, you're on crack. Right.
Right. Right.
And so they were able to do something very subtle and very, like, they couldn't get caught. It was like, it was such a subtle attack. And then 4.5 months later, and they completely got away with it. Like, nobody suspected it. And
if
I myself
that's what
was
happened.
Just, I was just starting to figure it out. I had just hired researchers in Ukraine and Russia to try to find the background of these people that were on. There were a bunch of Russians on board the plane, and I was researching their backgrounds when the other plane got shot down in over Ukraine. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, I was already had researchers in Ukraine. I mean, it was clearly about Ukraine. This is all spurred because Putin felt kind of existentially threatened by the collapse of his pro-Russian regime Ukraine. So for him, it's like that's a red line. Like Russians call Ukraine the near abroad. It's like it's part of their history. I mean, he just had this long mm-hmm. rant where he was talking mm-hmm. to Tucker Carlson. He's like, Yaroslav the Magnificent back in 763. And so, like, to him, it's like, you can't take Ukraine from us. So this is why we're in the world we are today, where the Russians are hacking into the DNC servers and, you know, hiring a guy to try to say that, you know, the whole Biden impeachment and everything, you know, it's all like they're thick. It's thick with Russian operatives.
Well, we're making quite a few leaps, though, right?
Sure.
I mean, say that not only was it not a pilot suicide, but that was likely a hijacking, and
right.
that it was the Russians, and
right.
that the Russians did it for a distraction, and it
oh,
fits
I
into,
mean, listen, I listen,
and I realize, believe me, I appreciate. I was going to ask you how your background in covering psychology has influenced your deep dive into this case, and I think that answer has been very clear.
I mean, in my defense, you asked me like, what's the motive, and it's like, I mean, once you start looking at the motive, it kind of unfolds very quickly, because whether or not MH370 was part of Russia's Cold War against us, we are in a Cold War against. I mean, that's a very uncontroversial statement.
Yeah, right? Which is heating up rapidly. That's for sure. All right, before we run out of time, a couple of other things that I want to ask you about this.
Sure.
Are there any parallels between Flight 370 and other aviation mysteries or disappearances that you find noteworthy?
Well, I mean, I've always wondered if MH370 was inspired by Air France 447.
Hmm.
That mystery. I mean, it was a mystery at the time. It got solved, so we don't think of it a mystery anymore. But from 2009 until 2011, like, Air France 447 was the great aviation mystery of the contemporary age, and it did fascinate people. It was a huge story. And I wonder if MH370 was sort of modeled on that as because for many aspects.
With crime running rampant in New York, you need to keep yourself and your family safe. Obtaining your concealed carry firearm licenses can be difficult and time-consuming. That's where MyFirstPistol.com comes in. They'll help you secure your concealed carry license. If you're looking for a pistol, premise, rifle, or shotgun license, call 347-559-7052. 347-559-7052. You must have a valid firearm license issued by the NYPD to purchase, possess, or shoot a handgun or pistol in NYC.
What do you think the next steps would be in solving this? What needs to happen next in terms of this investigation? And realistically, is this something that one day?
I think we have all the information we need. I think there needs to be some kind of a blue ribbon panel. I was in this Netflix documentary that aired a year ago, and there was a sort of flurry of interest at the time, and I wrote an article in an Australian newspaper saying, hey, everybody, don't forget this mystery. Like, you know, let's revive it. Let's, like, revive the investigation. And the comments that people were leaving was like, we've done enough. We spent a lot of money. We're sick of this. Like, leave us alone. But I think it's important. I mean, obviously, if this was an attack, we need to understand that's nature. And if it wasn't, then let's solve it. My ideas might be wrong. I will be the first to admit that. But I think that we need to really reawaken it. The search officials made some assumptions that proved wrong. Okay, what they thought happened to this plane was not right. If they had been right, they would have found the plane on the seabed. So I really want this to be reawakened. That's really my goal. I'm not trying to convince people that I have the right answer, mm-hmm. but I'm saying, mm-hmm. like, we have so much information. Let's piece it together.
There was a lot of criticism in the documentary. I saw it. I loved it. And I thought it was really interesting. And it did exactly what you say that you hope everything you're doing will do. And it reawakened my interest in the case. But you had some people calling it ludicrous. You had other folks saying that it deliberately peddled conspiracy theories.
Right.
Other folks said that it detailed three dubious explanations for the plane's disappearance. I'm sure you've heard those criticisms and many more. What did you make of those criticisms? Was that unfair?
I find it crazy because they were like, these are three conspiracy theories. First of all, the first theory is like I said, like that is the mainstream That's the normal theory. Like, that's normal. Like, if you think all of those are conspiracy theories, what do you think happened to the plane? Because, like I said, if you think it was like an accidental depressurization or something, we know that that didn't happen. So people who call it a crazy conspiracy theory really literally don't know what they're talking about. And if you want to criticize the sort of high-tech hijack theory, I get that that sounds pretty weird. But like, very few people have gone as deep into the evidence as me. And I'm telling you, it's like, this is what I like to say about this mystery. The closer you look at it, the weirder it gets. And if you're wondering what I mean by that, come listen to the podcast. I will explain to you exactly what I mean by that. I will say this, though. The third theory was bonkers. That was just ridiculous. So they're partly right.
All right. If people are interested in learning more, I hope they check out deepdivemh370.com. Jeff, I really enjoyed the conversation. I hope we can talk again.
Anytime, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. If you want to comment on any portion of our discussion, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-9222, 800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight, straight ahead.